Right then, team. We're not in a pub in London. We are, in fact, in our usual places in Studio 5 of Linux Voice Towers. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And this can mean only one thing, and that we are here together as one to bring you Series 5, Episode 12 of the Linux Voice podcast. If you... Oh, hang on. God, I get so confused nowadays. Now I'm really old. We've got news to come. We've got potentially a Neuron. We've got some finds. We've got a voice of the masses. And if you like the sound of all that, fear not. And because you can just press stop and rewind and listen to us again. you can also go look back into the mists of time, into the huge archive we've got of our previous podcasts. And you can read and indeed subscribe to Linux Magazine. That's linux-magazine.com. Is that right? Did I get the URL?
It's getting so good now. The remainder of the podcast is just one long downhill road.
No, well, let's not prejudge ourselves too harshly, because we need to keep up the momentum of awesomosity. Let's wait for the cynicism and hatred to come at 5:45 on Thursday after I failed dismally recording Mastermind.
Oh,
by the time you start listening to this, listeners,
yes, we will know.
if the clouds are rolling in from Mordor, the ring will have Andrew will have failed in his mission.
So will you know how the other competitors have done in your episode?
Yeah, because we're all there. We all sort of sit together, don't we? Because we need to shake hands like gentlemen at the end.
It's been years since I've seen Mastermind. I can't quite remember how it all works.
Well, I watched two episodes at random today as part of my training, and both of them had a question on golf scores. So I need to look at that, because 100% is a decent strike rate. Also, 50% of them had Rachel Riley off Countdown in. So there's something to look forward to.
Was that just your Google search, though?
Right, it's time for news.
Right, on with the news. First up this fortnight, is the news that Ubuntu is now in the Windows Store. So this is something we've talked about a few times before, that Ubuntu works on top of Windows. Ubuntu sort of being the user space, it runs on top of the I'm so used to saying the Linux kernel, I can barely bring myself to say the Windows kernel. It just sounds so horribly wrong. But essentially that's what it's doing. It runs exactly as it does usually, but with different bits underneath and a little sort of layer of glue sticking it together. And this is in the Windows Store, so you don't need to sort of jump through any hoops to install stuff. You just go, actually, I don't know how you install stuff on Windows. Is it like apt-get install? How do you use the Windows Store? I actually don't know this.
Yeah, that is. Oh, how do you use the Windows Store? I have no idea.
You probably just click on something. I don't know.
It's probably, a shopping icon. You click on the very flat two-dimensional shopping icon that's probably yellow on a bright blue background.
Yeah. Is the bright blue background the blue screen of death?
You need to give your credit card details at some point, probably really early on in the process before you know what you're going to buy.
Yeah. Yeah. Or it'll say, are these your credit card details that we already have? Yeah.
So anyway, there's some way of using the Windows Store. We assume it's quite easy, but none of us have used it.
I think it's quite funny. I was thinking of that Linus Torvalds quote from a million years ago, where he said something like, Linux will win when Microsoft is making applications for Linux. But now that Linux runs on Windows, I don't know what to think anymore. Yeah. It's all a bit confusing.
Yeah. So this, it's sort of basic level, it'll give you sort of command line stuff. You can run all that sort of stuff. I have seen pictures of people running graphical stuff as well, and I couldn't... that wasn't mentioned in the Microsoft blog post about this. I'm not completely sure whether it or not includes the graphical stuff.
Yes, I mean, I haven't looked into it that deeply either, but I was fairly certain there's no kind of bridge between whatever the Microsoft Windows graphics system is and what would be X11 or Xorg. Maybe they're frame buffer window managers that work. I don't know.
And the Microsoft also said they're working closely with Fedora and SUSE to get those distros running. Although they didn't say whether or not it was OpenSUSE or is it still called SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop SLED?
Yeah.
So that's there. That's the thing. That's something they're trying to persuade people to do.
I think it's good. I think you know, basically people are going to learn how to use Bash and how wonderful it is, and all the and the fact that you don't actually need to do much more else, and so you don't need all the Windows stuff going on around the outside.
Then why use Windows in the first place? I don't really get
it. Well, it's the entry drug. You know, it's the free hit.
Yeah, I can only see this really being a thing for developers. I can't see it in sort of ops people. I can't see this being a sort of general user thing, but I could be wrong.
No.
But
I mean, a lot of us spend a lot of time on the command line. It's not like it's particularly difficult. It's just becoming like so efficient and so effective, and it's frustrating. Even as good as PowerShell is in its own way, when you move to Windows and you can't do the same things.
Yeah, and it's Bash is, you know, often think of it as a Linux thing, but it's also a Mac thing, and it is really ubiquitous. And
ZSH, what is that, Ben? Zsh.
I've always known it as Zsh.
God, that freaked me out so much that last week.
Yeah,
well, you can't say ZSH. That's like three syllables.
Zsh. Zsh.
Why not?
It's Bash and Zsh. You don't say BASH. What do you just
ZSH
call it?
leaves no room for ambiguity. So when you have to explain when you have to get across what you're talking about to somebody, you do it in three syllables. If you say Zsh, you've not cut the number of syllables by, you know, two thirds. Instead, you need to then launch into a paragraph about what on earth you mean when you say Zsh. It's an illusion of efficiency that's just sucked you in there, Ben. Resist.
Don't know how angry you're going to get when you find out that I just called the shell sure. What about Seesh?
There's K shell as well. Kush.
I never know. And T Seesh. I never know what to call whether that's T C S H or
T C shell.
Yeah.
T C shell.
I've always called it T Seesh. But to be fair, I say that. I've only said it like three times in my entire life, and twice of those are in the last sentence.
These are all sounds that sound terrible on MP3 as well, so everything will turn into...
that's the real question that no one's answered here. Yeah, what are they going to call their various shell environments on Windows? Right, shall we move more to the realm of Linux again? And that is that Fedora 26 has been released. It comes with lots of upgrades to the latest things, GCC 7, other... They put their version of Golang in the release notes. Who puts a version of Golang in the release notes now? Just the fact that it was even mentioned seemed modern and strange to me.
Does that just mean they've got nothing else to shout about?
I mean, it was this sort of usual raft of upgrades without any sort of big flashy news things. But at the rate distros are released these days, you can't put flashy release announcement things in every release. It'd be crazy. It's just new stuff is more good.
Yeah, I kind of miss that. I feel like Linux misses out a little bit in the fanfare of a big release that you get with everything else like Windows and Mac OS and major proprietary applications, and you can really shout about what effectively has been a rolling release for 2 years, but then you can say, wow, look at this, isn't it amazing? Printing just works.
No, you just need to install Slackware, Graham, then you get that feeling with every release.
Oh, well, great work for the Fedora people. It's great that Fedora is still such a strong and popular distribution.
Yeah. Right, more Linux news. The CIA has been targeting Linux machines. And this isn't really a surprise to anyone, I don't think. But it's just been interesting to see a couple of the ways in which they've been doing it have been released on WikiLeaks. One of them is Outlaw Country, which... isn't that a fact? That's, isn't that the name of the music style they have on Archer? When Cheryl says Outlaw Country.
Wow.
Anyway.
I have just no idea what you're talking about. You could have just said zish to me and it just goes...
it sounds like Willie Nelson's been exposing the CIA.
Yes, but, well, basically Outlaw Country was an IP tables hack thing that allowed them to route all your traffic via one of their servers so they could spy on what you were running. Not what you were running, sorry, what you were sending in and out, data packets and the like. And another was an exploit for stealing SSH credentials from sessions. So every time you SSH into something, they could whip away either your password or your private key and presumably then log into the machines themselves and tinker with stuff.
You know, how was that a vulnerability that allowed them to do that?
There's not a huge amount of detail in either one. I mean, obviously with the SSH stuff, if they can get something to run as the user, as your user, then they can read your SSH credentials.
The IP table, I think it's interesting. The IP tables one, I think, is interesting because I've always found it so horrendously complicated. I always wonder whether, you know, as great as the complexity allows you to build a firewall in Linux, whether it's actually counterproductive if you can't understand everything that's going on and correctly manage it. I don't know if this is an example of that.
IP tables isn't that complex. It's all right.
Well, maybe when you, I don't know, I list all the rules and I would have no idea if there was an extra superfluous rule in there that was letting the CIA spy on everything that I sent across a network.
Yeah, no, I know all my IP tables rules.
that's the difference between you and me. That's why I'm just a lightweight.
And I spend my days reading IP tables configs. Yes, and last up on our Linux news this fortnight is that Let's Encrypt will be issuing wildcard certificates from next year. So this is a wildcard certificate is where you, it's an SSH certificate that can cover anything at, for example, .linuxvoice.com. So it can be www.linuxvoice.com, I don't know, ftp.linuxvoice.com or whatever, .linuxvoice.com, which is really useful if you're sort of managing a lot of domains, particularly if you've got sort of back-end ones, you might have like data.linuxvoice.com.
Yeah, some people have hundreds, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. And going through and manually updating each one is a real hassle. So what most people do is they just get long lasting certificates, which isn't great for security. Let's Encrypt sort of limit you to 90 days, and to get a new one for everyone every 90 days is just a pain, really. So
yeah,
the easiest thing is not to bother.
I've never understood technically why the wildcard certificates were so different. And they couldn't, I mean, yeah, it'd be really good actually if you know.
I believe the challenge isn't sort of any technical thing or anything like that. It's being sufficiently confident that you issue it to the right person.
Right.
So if you're issuing one for example, www.linuxvoice.com, it's really easy to verify that you own that machine. You can put something at www.linuxvoice.com/blah. And that's it. Whereas if it might
and that's
be
that's what Let's Encrypt does, isn't it, automatically?
Yeah, yeah. But to have a wildcard, you have to be able to show that you own everything in that domain, which, you know, you might only rent a small portion of for whatever reason. So that's, at least I believe that's the challenge. It's the sort of verification that you're giving the right certificate to the right person that's difficult, not any technical reason.
Right. Well, that is brilliant. I know it's putting some people out of business, but if it makes the internet more secure, like Let's Encrypt has done, which is really, I mean, I think we all use it. I certainly use it. It's just made a huge difference to my personal email account, my personal Nextcloud account, my web server, all of these things. It feels so good to have a proper green HTTPS connection whenever I use them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's never been hard to do SSL, but it's always just been that extra little bit of hoop jumping to go through. And
you know, just so many of those companies, they reminded me of like the free DNS servers that gave you a forwarding internet www address for your own, you know, broadband connection. They were always so cagey and always sending you reminders about their commercial offerings and making you get a new certificate without any kind of scripts or way of automating it. You know, you don't feel like a second class citizen with Let's Encrypt.
Yeah. So that's the Linux news this fortnight.
Brilliant. Thank you, Ben. So it is time for Finds of the Fortnight. Luckily, collective sigh, there isn't that much on IRC. I've got to scroll back a little bit. From James Olympus, details of bridges owned by Network Rail have been made available in spreadsheet form. He provides a link to that. I think that's pretty cool.
I assume he means physical bridges, not their networking hardware.
Yeah, I think so. Physical bridges, because he's written a Perl script to convert the data to KML. So you can load up this data into Google Earth, which sounds cool. Sounds really cool if you want to see Network Rail landmarks. It's really, well, I really like, you know, the fact that the data's open and just not hidden somewhere, you know, the fact that if somebody wants to put bridges on a map, then you can.
Well, so presumably there's sort of quite an, for some people, it's quite an important point in that those bridges obviously have a minimum, a maximum height that can get through them. And that's...
Yeah.
That's got to be important for some routing software or something.
Yeah, you're right. And I found John the Nice Guy's finds. The first one is I Want, a decentralized peer-to-peer file sharing command line application. That sounds really good. It sounds like, I can't remember the name of the tool from a couple of years ago, but basically you get a unique URL on the command line for the file that you want to give to somebody. Then there's Magma, which he says it seems to be an implementation of an XKCD idea, how do standards proliferate.
Cool.
And I think, Cron Weekly, a weekly newsletter for Linux and open source sysadmins, though that is the source of his finds, so that may be worth subscribing to if you find those finds interesting. Does anyone else want to share a find?
I will, because I don't think I've been in the last two podcasts, so my finds have been building up.
You okay, Mike?
Who's this fella?
Everything's wunderbar, apart from working ridiculous hours, but one find, some of you may know already, is that the Hobgoblin is closing. Yeah, for those who aren't aware, this was a pub just around the corner from where we all used to work at some random company in Bath. I remember, Graham, you and I spent many a lunchtime pint there used to play pool upstairs, used to watch Andrew put Sisters of Mercy on the jukebox there as well.
I always remember sitting in the cellar and the toilets above would leak, so that whenever anyone flushed the toilets, the water would come through the ceiling.
I'd forgotten about the cellar. I was trying to imagine it in my head. I remembered the ground floor bit and the pool tables upstairs that weren't in great condition at least a few years ago. But anyway, it's a bit sad that pub is closing.
It kind of sounds like it should have been shut down years ago, to be honest.
That was good about it, wasn't it? It obviously resisted gentrification.
Yeah.
And cholera.
Well, God, you should have seen. I mean, I think we all resorted to drinking bottled beer there in the end.
Yeah, I never drank anything on draft there after about 2006.
Anyway, the end of an era for that. My next find was actually from Thomas Umbach, who works for Vikings.net. That's a really cool, super pro free software a group of people who do fully free Libre hosting, and they do the customized ThinkPads that respect your freedom and stuff like that. Really, really cool guys. He was listening to one of our recent podcasts, and we were talking about how Trisquel and GNUSense, it's a terrible name, are quite out of date. So, you know, the super free software distros are getting a bit old. But he pointed me to Parabola GNU/Linux. He says it's basically a Libre Arch Linux, and I've heard of Parabola a few times, you know, on my travels around the internet, but having a quick look at it, it looks quite good if you want to go fully free right down to every bit and byte. Of course, like Arch, you know, you probably need to know what's what you're doing to set it up. But yeah, Parabola GNU/Linux looks kind of cool.
Oh, excellent. And then,
sorry, Graham?
Yeah, no, it does sound really good. I keep meaning to try it, actually.
Yeah, yeah, I'd like to try it on the on this Libreboot ThinkPad, ThinkPad I've got here that's super free down to the BIOS as well. And then the third find was I came across an interview with Matthew Smith, the creator of Manic Miner. Some of us remember that Manic Miner, it's probably even before my time, really. Manic Miner was a platform game for the ZX Spectrum that came out, I think, in 1983 or 84.
Yeah.
And the programmer of it was a bit of a sort of enigma. He wrote the game, got a chunk of money, and disappeared off the gaming scene for about 5-10 years. And there was a whole internet cult set up to trying to find him. Like, where had he gone? He'd just gone off to the Netherlands and lived in a commune. But I came across a quote from him in the late 90s, somebody managed to get hold of him and had sent him an email, and he replied back saying what he's doing, and he said, "So I did Manic Miner in a GEM window on the Atari ST. The game was finished and working, but GEM was too horrible to work on at the same time. I learned how to program dodgy, event-driven catastrophes, though, so Windows is a doddle now. I was working up to version 0.8 on a football game for the ST, and I was working on version 0.3 of a Road Rash/Doom/Frontier combo game on the PC. The discs for all of these have passed away," he said. Matthew Smith was working on a game that combined Road Rash, Doom, and Frontier. I want to know what that game would have been like. Obviously, many of us are massive Frontier fans here. Road Rash I used to play quite a bit on the Mega Drive. Doom was all right. I'm never a super big fan of it, but Road Rash.
Yeah, I can give or take Doom, but Imagine in a dogfight being able to lean out and kick someone.
And then they go in front of another ship and they go, like, "Whoa!" Yeah. And then the cops come and pull up. He seems to be quite a hard guy to get hold of, but I'd love to know more about this Road Rash Doom Frontier combo game.
Yeah.
I mean, if he only got up to version 0.3 of it and he wasn't doing much other stuff, then maybe it wasn't that impressive anyway. But nonetheless, just to think that that guy was working on such a game.
Did you see, Mike, that Nintendo are doing the same thing that they did with the NES with the SNES or Super Famicom?
The NES, the Super NES Mini or SNES Classic, or they've said they're going to produce many, many more units of this. Like the NES Classic, they underproduced enormously. Time I was in England, I think I saw one in a computer exchange for £190. People are selling them all on eBay. So with the SNES Mini, which is, I'm actually quite tempted to buy. I'm not that fussed about the NES, but...
Well, the thing that reminded me was that I think, I hope I've got the right title, I think it includes Star Fox 2, which was never released, which was famously created, and I think the cartridges, many cartridges made, but the thing never got... And Star Fox was one of the most fantastic titles on the SNES. In particular, I mean, for those of us with an Amiga background, it was Jez San, who made Star Glider on the Amiga, came up with an incredible way of generating these 3D graphics on low-powered machines who went off, and then was it the Super Effects chip or something in the SNES cartridges, and, you know, really paved the way for 3D graphics in the future of console gaming. And so I think that's really neat if it is Star Fox 2 that's in there.
It is. Star Fox 2 was pretty much finished but never released because it came at the end of the Super Nintendo lifespan, and Nintendo wanted everyone then to go to the N64.
Yeah.
So that's where 3D graphics are. You know, they did the opposite of Sega. Sega were bringing out sort of the interstitial consoles, like the 32X and stuff, and they completely messed up. And Nintendo were like, "Nope, you want 3D, now go to the N64. Well, so this game was finished and never released.
I kind of remember, I may be making this up, that it was, do you remember that the initial prototypes of the PlayStation were actually for a SNES with a CD-ROM drive, using the SuperFX chip. And I think maybe the Star Fox 2 was also postponed slightly in the hope, or maybe, that it might be a launch title for this Nintendo-Sony collaboration.
Could possibly be, yeah. For those interested in gaming history, what happened with the PlayStation is fascinating. It was meant to be a CD add-on for the Super Nintendo, and Nintendo got really far into development with Sony with this, and then Hiroshi Yamauchi, the famously angry boss of Nintendo, was a million years old, just turned around one day and said, "Nope, bye," and Sony rage quitted, and then said, "Right, we're going to make our own console," and then beat Nintendo in the next generation, and
yeah.
The rest is history. But yeah, SNES Mini, Star Fox 2, the N64 Mini, that's the one where I will be queuing up for 6 hours outside of
yeah. Although, shop. You know, emulating those things is, even though it's nice to give, I've bought a lot of those games anyway that are on those consoles, but with the N64 in particular, the emulators are so good. You know, there's even a virtual reality mod for some of them, so you can play Mario 64 in VR, which is incredible.
But the big reason a lot of people want an N64 Mini is so that they can get new N64 controllers, because
I've got three here.
Are they in decent condition?
Yeah, they're all right.
You can probably sell them for a bit of money. I've got four brand new ones. It's basically my retirement plan, because they wear out quite quickly, and yet people are speedrunning these Nintendo games. I saw at the weekend there was a speedrunning event. 200,000 people tuned in live to watch a guy play Mario 64.
Oh, man, that's incredible.
It was. He's like some 20-year-old kid from Spain. He's so good at it, and he's really entertaining to watch. He's so fast. 200,000 people watching. But he was saying getting hold of really good, you know, fresh N64 controllers is really difficult. So I'm going to keep mine for another, 40 years and then sell them to speedrunners.
Actually, you reminded me with another one of your finds. That, in fact, I think it was when you were booting up your ThinkPad to record the podcast. Did you see the news that I think Lenovo is going for the 25th anniversary of the ThinkPad, is going to create one of those original ThinkPads on a limited edition version, which would be awesome.
Yeah. This is getting back to Linux at least a bit. There's a hardcore group of people. Say hardcore. There's a bunch of decent geeks who are just sick with all these laptops with the silly little wobbly thin keyboards, and they want a decent ThinkPad again. And Lenovo sort of recognised this. Now, it's probably more marketing stunts than actually they're looking at a big market. They may only sell 10,000 of them max, but if they win some people back, especially after the Silverfish, or what was the name of that dreadful software they installed on?
It wasn't even in the BIOS, was it? It was on the management interface.
Some horrible thing, something fish. So I think Lenovo wants to win back a few geeks, and if they can produce a ThinkPad, it'd probably be a bit clunky and heavy, but not everybody wants super thin MacBook Airs. Anyway, those are my finds.
Sorry, yeah, thanks, Mike. So one of my, try not to be too retro with my find, on a practical level, I've been doing rather a lot with Vim, because I find it quite, I don't know if I've described this in the podcast before, but I find it, writing stuff in Vim is a bit like learning how to do the Rubik's Cube while you're being productive. I like it for that reason. and I've been doing a lot of Git with Vim, and so there's this Git wrapper for Vim called Fugitive, which is brilliant. It doesn't do anything you can't do on the command line or with the exclamation mark in Vim, but it adds a load of commands like gstatus and gcommit and gwrite, which automatically adds and saves something into the staging environment of Git. And it's just a really convenient, easy way of working with Git from within Vim. I mean, I'm not like one of these big turn your editor into an IDE kind of people, but it's so convenient. Oh, the best thing about it is it's got gblame. Blame in Git is where you can see each contributor for each line of code. And the interface is really neat in that you can see all the contributors on the left and you can see all the lines on the right, and you can easily see who's it shouldn't be blame, it should be bless, or it's a very Linus Torvalds naming
for a
command.
It's a Linus thing, yeah.
But it's a really great interface to Git. It works better in Vim for certain things like that and the diffs and the changelogs and stuff than it does actually just on the command line.
You know, I very rarely write any code these days, so I don't get to use Vim much because I'm doing mostly plain text, and I don't really particularly like using Vim for just editing words, I'll use, well, LibreOffice or Nano. So I kind of missed that in a way. When I use Vim to edit code and I learn more shortcuts and macros, yeah. I feel like I'm king of the world running this editor. It feels so good. But when I'm just juggling a text paragraph of a press release, it's like, well, it's not quite the same.
Oh, you should just use Vim anyway.
Yeah, but I wouldn't feel like I'm using it for... Yeah. You don't have syntax highlighting in press releases, you know?
Hey, you just said you use LibreOffice or Nano. That's quite a range in that.
Yeah, you know. So what, Vim is some happy medium there. What?
Okay, so my next find is Wikipedia the Text Adventure. Did anyone see this? This is this is a website, effectively, although I think you can download the code. It when you go to the website, it looks exactly like one of those interactive fiction games by Infocom, except for the game packaging lets you choose a subject on Wikipedia. I'm on there now. If I click on, for example, Forbidden City, I basically get a synopsis from the Wikipedia page written and illustrated just like it would be a text adventure game. I wonder if I could... Obviously, people can't... listeners at home can't see what I'm going to do, but I'm going to share my window with people so that they can get a live reaction. Can you see that? So the text Forbidden City. Wow. So it says you can go northeast to the Zenren Temple, east to St. Joseph's Church. So I can type east here. And then I've gone to this Catholic church, and these are all entries within Wikipedia.
Is that actually north of the Forbidden City?
Yes, because it's using the description on Wikipedia of what's north of that actual place to construct this map.
That is epic.
Best find ever.
Yeah, so this is really cool. And while I'm sharing the screen, my final find is that work? This is C64 yourself. And this is another website, but you can download the codes on GitHub, which basically you drag and drop an image. I've got an image here ready because look at this preparation. I'm dragging an image. It's loading it. You see the C64 on the screen. Oh, yes. And then it turns whatever image you drop onto it into a C64 RMS. Image.
Wow.
That's so cool.
Pretty epic.
So that's C64 yourself.
Does my microphone work now?
And they are my finds.
Yeah, I've got a couple of finds. My first one is that the apt command, I always thought apt was just an alias of apt-get on Ubuntu, but apparently it's not. It's a different command with a different set of stuff. Very slightly different, to be fair. Yeah. And it's, and it's actually got more, it's got both less and more than apt-get. There's some stuff it can do and some stuff it can't do. And you get some of the stuff mapped cache as well, so you can search with it. And it's just a bit of a more friendly interface as well.
So was it ever meant to be like a sequel to apt-get, or is it just a project that's kind of spawned differently?
I think it's meant to be a sort of more beginner-friendly, not even necessarily beginner-friendly, but more sort of friendly version of apt-get. Apt-get's got all the commands for doing all sorts of weird, specific stuff that's probably going to break your system. But sometimes you just want to do it anyway. Whereas apt is much more just get something from the repository and install it or get rid of it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I didn't know that. I always thought it was a bit of a wrapper, actually, for apt-get.
Yeah. And the other thing I found this fortnight is OpenSnitch, which I haven't had a chance to try yet, but it's a clone of the Little Snitch application firewall for Mac, which basically limits your internet connection per application. Every time a particular app wants to access the internet, it says, Firefox wants to access the internet. And you go, well, yeah, obviously it does. I'll click allow. Then it might be like this weird thing in the background wants to access the internet. And you're like, not so sure about that one. And you can, you can see what's accessing the internet. You can allow it and block it on a per application basis and a per time basis as well. So, it's
quite that a good one. Especially really good, actually, yes. Like an Android, I suppose.
Yeah, a lot like that. And if you don't know your IP tables rules off by heart.
The CAA is trying to access its secret database. Yeah.
Definitely not CIA.exe is trying to access perfectly normal website.com.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben.
So my two discoveries
are that Foss Talk Live is still awesome. We were there last week, as you will know if you've listened to the last podcast. It was lovely. I'm just slightly perturbed because I can hear myself through somebody's speakers or somebody's headphones going back into the thing. My other discovery, or find indeed, is that the 12th of July, Wednesday, tomorrow, or yesterday, depending on when you listen to this, is the internet-wide day of net neutrality. So go and do whatever it is it takes to be neutral on the internet. I intend to not look at the internet, which I think is about as neutral as you can get. But I think when the organisers say internet-wide, what they actually mean is America. So people will be emailing their senators and other representatives. So if you are one of those Americans, why not join in?
Is this where you just sort of type comments on websites saying, I have no strong opinions on this?
Yeah, that's the thing to do.
It's a beige alert. Yeah, I get what Ben's saying.
Yeah, sign into Facebook saying, yeah, I'm all for net neutrality.
That'll show them.
Yeah. Put a link to Neptune, you know, the EFF. Yeah.
Right, so that's me.
Excellent. They are all our finds.
Right, so we are about 90% of the way through, which means it's time for our halfway reminder. Still to come, we have neurons with which to vocalise, and we have the voice of the masses, which brings us to Mike.
It does indeed. We have a sort of neuron. I mean, this was sent to our info@linuxvoice.com address, but from a Mr. Jonathan Gregory. I don't know if he's any relation, Andrew, but he asked us to read out this anyway. He said, "Hello, guys. This may be a stupid question, but I'm confused about security on Linux. We are constantly told that Linux is inherently more secure as there are no viruses or malware in the wild for Linux, as the underlying system architecture makes changes to the file system impossible without root privileges. So far, so good. But if this is the case, how come every couple of days I'm downloading shedloads of security updates?" Well, Jonathan, it's a good question. Couple of answers. It's not so much that nothing can change the file system without having root privileges. I mean, you know, random end user software can be attacked and it can change things in your home directory, and that can be just as bad. I think there's an XKCD comic about how, you know, someone's saying, well, Unix is so secure. Okay, people can steal all my home data and my banking password and everything, but they can't change my message of the day in /etc. So yeah, it's you know, exploits still exist out there. And then you could look at it on the positive side. There are security vulnerabilities in large pieces of software, like a giant desktop operating system with office suites and browsers, and it's good that they are fixed quickly. So there are lots of security updates floating around for Linux distros coming out every few days. But you know, that's better than the Microsoft style waiting for Patch Tuesday where everything's bundled up or people sit on vulnerabilities for ages. So
yeah,
look at the positives of it. That's what I'd say.
Also, I think Linux is just so widely used now that these things are getting, there's more eyeballs on everything that's being used and seen, and people are it's getting fixed, you know.
I think a big reason why you see so many more updates in Linux than you'd probably expect to see in, say, Windows or Mac OS is because everything comes through the same channel. You get all your, like, almost all your software is probably installed through your package manager, and that's, you know, your Firefox web browser or Chrome or whatever. Actually, not Chrome, but anyway. Yeah, LibreOffice, everything on there. So any security update to any one of them comes down through that. And on, you know, Windows or Mac OS, what you'd probably find is a lot of the software did have more recent versions released with bug fixes and all that, but because it's not managed by a central software repository, you never get those bug fixes, those security patches and the rest of it, which is part of the problem.
Yeah, actually, Ben's answer is even better than, far better than what I was saying. Actually, yeah, that's probably the biggest reason. Yeah, you install the Linux distro on your desktop. You've got a huge number of packages on there, all from a central source. That's a good thing. Yeah, there will be lots of updates. You know that the whole operating system and the apps are being maintained. So, anyway, we hope that answers your question and your. Yep.
So yeah, and just to add that the vast majority of those security vulnerabilities are absolutely minor, almost impossible to trigger. So it's not like, don't panic about it. Just keep installing them and it should be fine.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The in the open source world, you know, release early, release often, fix things early. Don't sit around waiting because of marketing or anything like that. That's a good thing. Yeah. So, yeah, we hope, Jonathan, that answers your question and sort of relieves you a bit from your concerns. If anybody else has a neuron they want to be vocalized, simply email me via my colleague at graham@linuxvoice.com.
Is that email me via my secretary?
I was thinking of saying that, but I didn't want to.
You obviously don't read the podcast notes, because that's exactly what I put last time.
But I guess they were sent to mike@linuxvoice.com, which
no, I said if you want to get in touch with Mike, email his secretary, graham@linuxvoice.com.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, there we go.
Right, that brings us steaming on to Voice of the Masses, where we asked, an oldie but a goodie, what's your favourite CLI tool /trick? The command line. It's always there. It's always lurking in the background, like fear itself. So, Shlomo Dubrovin says a big load of commands, which kind of shows the limitations of this section on a podcast, because I'm not going to read that out, but. Might have been helpful to say what it's for as well, actually. But if you do fancy seeing what other people have got to say, do come to linuxvoice.com/voiceofthemasses, because that's where it is, and there will be tips for you.
I can see what it's doing is it's rsync. It's copying. The first one is an alias for rsync that allows you to copy files with a single command rather than having to remember the rsync arguments.
Okay, cool. So that brings us to Keith Peters, who says, I have a .bash_aliases file that's sourced at startup. Any complex commands I type more than a few times get their own alias.
Yeah, that's such a good one. For so many years, actually, I just typed the same things over and over and over and over. It took me ages to finally getting around to not just adding aliases, but just putting those commands in a separate bin folder that I add to my path so that I don't have to keep doing the same thing again.
You see, I never do that. I just control R everything.
I do it. And really geekily, I sync it with across Git, because I use a couple of machines so that I can get the same configuration on whatever machine I'm using. It's become so essential. And these scripts only have like 3 or 4 commands in them.
Did you say control and R everything, Ben?
Yep.
Okay, what does that do? Tell us what that does.
I think I've probably scooping someone else's trick here, but essentially it searches through your history. So you hit Control and R, then you start typing, and it will look back through commands you've previously typed and find the ones that match what you're typing.
Right, saving time, but also reminding you of when you last used things.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing it does have a few issues with is you've got multi-line commands, which just from what I'm doing, got some big curl commands that sort of do various things. And they just sort of, it just seems to, doesn't confuse it, but it just messes up the terminal, and there's the massive stuff, and I don't know what command I'm in the middle of, which is probably where I should create aliases.
Can I also mention that this was difficult? I mentioned this at FozTalk Live a couple of weeks ago. The FZF thing that was my find, which is like this fuzzy search, it allows you to type in, like, it make searching on the command line like a Google search, but it does this for stuff in your path, but it also does it for things in your history. So it works with Control R, so you don't have to type exactly the command. If you can type around the command, if you've got some kind of memory of what it was, what the command was, it'll try and do a fuzzy search on your history, which is really useful. FZF.
It's not good enough to do like that command where I deleted the stuff. Yeah, and yeah.
Or that command on that other machine or before I reinstalled whatever it was.
Okay, yes, Controller, you're right, Ben. You did bomb Joe Ressington and Carl Ove Hufthammer's discoveries there. Luke, this is quite a dirty one here. Sudo exclam exclam. I guess that's really irresponsible and should not be tried by anyone.
Yeah, that must be repeat the previous command, but with root privileges. So that's a very mighty weapon to harness.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And can I just add, because did anyone know that as sudo bang bang?
No.
I obviously don't go to the same places you do.
Okay. I know exclamation marks as bang when I read out the script. Never mind. It's obviously just me.
So bang, bang, bang is bash for the previous command.
Yeah.
So yeah, you've got to be careful, I guess, because if the previous command was rm-rf, forward slash, and oh no, you need sudo for that. Sudo bang, bang would do it.
At the risk of sounding too geeky, no, it wouldn't.
That was one of your
because you also need no preserve root at the end.
Gah.
Okay, here's a funky one, also from Carl Ove Hufthammer. My favourite tip is prefixing a command with colon space, which makes the command do nothing.
Ah,
but it saves it in the command history.
Sorry, I use hash. The hash pound sign to do exactly the same thing, especially if I'm trying to create a command and I don't know all of the arguments and it's a long one. I'll type it out and then I'll do control and A to go to the beginning of the command, put a hash there, press return and go and look what I want to do and then go up arrow to get to it.
Oh, that's cool.
I was trying to work out why. That does sound really handy, actually. I think you're just leaving comments in your history file otherwise.
Yeah.
Okay, Russell Dickinson says, my latest favourite is AG, also known as the Silver Searcher. Clever. It's essentially grep on steroids. Yeah. I thought grep was already pretty roidy, to be honest. It's we've done several tutorials on grep and orc and sed and all those things about all the mad ways that you can extend them and make them do exactly what you want, but I like the name. It's clever. It's cool. It reminds me I need to stare at the periodic table for a few minutes.
I think actually what it does is, from memory, because grep doesn't really allow you to process the results like you can with orc or sed, and I think AG allows you to do more with the results than you can just with plain grep. So do a bit of search and replace or whatever it happens to be. Maybe I don't know to the extent of it. I've not used it. Mike's gone to get another beer.
Okay, good. He does right. I think my wine is downstairs getting drunk, probably. There will be none left. But now it's time for a discovery from a voice of the masters from Stuart, who says, the wonderful get-iPlayer for getting BBC TV and radio programmes.
Yeah, that is brilliant, isn't it? So good if you've got kids and you're about to go on a long journey in the car somewhere and you quickly use Get iPlayer to grab all the CBB stuff and stick it on their tablets.
We'll say that is one that I've actually used, as well as LV and CD. LS, rather. Blimey, I can't even remember that.
There's some great tips, actually, aren't there, on that comment? I'm just reading them through. They're really interesting.
There's what I'm not sure if it came up in our comments yet, but there's a command or a utility you can install. I'm going to call it flip here because we're family friendly, but you can imagine what the real name of the command is. But what it does is it tries to correct your previous command. So, you know, if you're getting angry at the command line, like if you type apt get install something and you get the message saying, you know, you're not root, you simply type flip or the real word and it will fix your command by adding sudo before it. So I imagine it's a way of like the end of a hard day and you're just typing in something that doesn't work and you just, oh, flip, type it in and everything's back to normal.
Yeah. That's probably got that little CIA backdoor in it.
Right, that brings us to the end. This is the end. Time to go and do other things because it's getting late.
Cool.
So,
like what?
Tune in next fortnight and find out how everything's going and stuff like that.
And how you did on Mastermind? Will you be allowed to say?
I don't know. I don't think I probably will be allowed to say. I don't think it's really practicable to keep it a secret, but I'm going to try anyway.
Okay.
I'm going to present a smokescreen of disinformation.
We'll try and pry it out of you.
I'm going to email it to some Russian lads.
Yeah. I'm going to have a load of George Orwell finds and see if you correct me.
All right, everybody. It's been delightful. See you in 2 weeks. Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.